So welcome to the Life Path Dialogues again, and I'm Carla Woody, and our subject matter tonight is about inclusion and the ways of inclusion. And I have here with me tonight is my special guest is Yakin Lance Sandlaban, and he's a Sufi teacher, ordained Sufi minister, and a lot of other things that he's going to talk about a little bit later. What I'd like to do to kind of create a framework for this discussion tonight is tell a story and that kind of took me on an odyssey of a sort, and maybe it'll kind of create a frame for what we're doing tonight. A number of years ago, I was looking at going to India. I was really, really drawn to go to India. It was like I had this visceral pull to do that. And I knew that if I went, that it was going to be a very important journey for me. I also knew that it was important to go with people that I felt would ground me. And so Shabda Khan, who is a Sufi leader, and also was a master musician and classical vocal teacher in raga, you know, which is the Indian classical vocal music. He had a program, and I decided that having had some experience with Shabda, that he would be a very good one to go with, you know. And not only would he support the process, but he's very good at grounding. So I will preface this a little bit by saying to you that back in 1978, I spent 6 months in Iran. I was over in Tehran working. I turned 25 over there, so that was quite an experience, you know, to go all the way around the world and at that age and so forth and live and work there and so on. So I had that experience. And I loved it there. I absolutely loved it. It was also falling down around our ears at that point, so I experienced that aspect of it as well. But here's what happened, is that when we flew into Delhi, and we were flying in, you know, my partner at the time, we flew in together, and we would be meeting the people at the hotel where we were staying in Delhi. And what I remember is that it seemed to me that we landed in the middle of the night. It was like 3 a.m. or something like that, and that's just how it is when you fly halfway around the world. And so we found a taxi, and we had our journey to the hotel. And I just remember looking out the window and having this internal dialogue with myself where everything I looked at, I said, oh, I've seen that before, you know, that it was, I'm used to this, I've seen this before. You know, now the streets were fairly deserted, there were people out there, but, and of course it was in the middle of the night, but I was looking at the way that the shop fronts were and the streets and, you know, some of the animals in the streets and that kind of thing, and it's like, oh, I've seen all this before. This isn't anything new. And so we spent some time in Delhi and a lot of meditation and a lot of using your voice, you know, to be in meditation and to, you know, have spiritual practice in that way. We stayed in Delhi for a few days. But then we went to Jaipur. And when we went to Jaipur, we were actually staying on a Maharaji's old hunting lodge. And that sounds very romantic and like it might have been a really lush place, but it was pretty basic, actually, you know. I mean, it was a compound where you were sequestered. And so, I mean, we were in practice something like, I don't know, 6 hours a day or something like this. So you can imagine what that must have been like, and did not go outside, you know, for this period of time at all. So it's just continual in this way. And then one day, in this piece of it, I don't really remember. I don't remember if we decided that we needed a break and kind of skipped practice, or or what, but we went outside the compound, and there was this this guy, and a lot of them, you know, I mean, they kind of line up with the rickshaws, you know, they're waiting for people to come out, these drivers are, so they can engage with you and take you where you want to go. And I remember this guy, I've still got a picture of him, his name was Chow Tu Singh, and he had this rickshaw, and you know, he came up to us and engaged us, and we didn't really have any idea about where we wanted to go or anything like that, but we did want to go look at some handicrafts or some such thing. So we got in the back of that rickshaw, and he took us through, I really have to feel that absolutely the worst parts of town, you know, and all these back roads, and then in the middle of the traffic, and so we had every aspect of it. Now, I was feeling perfectly fine, really good when we left, and we were not out there but about, I would say, 10 minutes when all of a sudden it's like everything I saw was entering me. There's a lot of suffering on the streets of India. Absolutely everything I saw. And it was like there the veil was very thin, and it just entered me. I began to get ill. First I got a sore throat, I started getting fever. He took us to a place and I couldn't stay. We had to turn around and go back. And I don't even know how to adequately describe to you what appeared to be happening to me. I had no logical explanation for it. Through that night, I was extraordinarily ill. Tears were coursing down my cheeks. It's like I didn't know where this was coming from. What was all this? It was like the most incredible sadness, the most incredible hopelessness that I had ever experienced in my life. And I was wondering to myself, is this mine? I don't know. Is it mine? Is it somebody else's? You know, when the veil gets that thin, and I began to, you know, because I'm an energy worker as well, I actually began to, you know, do self-healing with that through the night. And when I woke up, or, you know, and I didn't wake up, I mean, as far as I was up all night with that, but the next morning it began to clear. And as it began to clear, it was as though I had been through some kind of incredible cleanse, you know? And I felt like I had been essentially washed clean of something, like it was an initiation of sorts. And I have to say to you that I did not in that moment understand what was going on. And it took me some years to really understand what was going on. This happened in the late 90s. It took me 2 years to even integrate, having been in India, to the point that I was ready to go anywhere else. And what I realized was that I was so fearful when I arrived there. Now, obviously, I was going for a spiritual journey, right? You know, I was very clear about that. But the minute that I got there, it was like I was pushing everything away. It's like, oh, I've seen that before. This is nothing to me. I can take that. I can put this shield up and so forth, because of some of the things that I was seeing were just so upsetting to me and so different. And so what this is really about for me has to do with inclusion. You know, it's how willing are we to include every aspect of life that is out there? How willing are we to include those aspects of ourself, maybe, that we don't want to look at? You know? Those ones that we've been pushing away for a long time. You know, are we willing to bring them up out of the darkness and just to be in that space? So the Sufi traditions, one of the reasons that I have always been drawn to the Sufi traditions in the last, in the last, I don't know, 15 years or so, is that they are very inclusive, you know? There's no dogma attached that I've ever found within the Sufi traditions. They welcome every other spiritual tradition and make them a part of their own and use them. So that's why I invited Yaqeen to be here tonight, is to kind of enlarge upon what I've said and how the Sufi traditions are relevant or maybe not relevant to what I've presented here. And I just want to say to you all that he's a very good friend of mine, and he's an old friend of mine. When I first came to Prescott all these years ago, I was astounded that there was actually a Sufi community here in Prescott, and that the man that I had gone to India with, Shabda Khan, that they actually used to have him here about once a year. Lance, at that point in time, held zikr in his home. And he'll talk more about that. It was a beautiful thing. It's a Sufi circle of devotion, and I attended that regularly for years. And I also want to give a plug that he has recently started that up again, and he'll talk to you about that later. But Lance, why don't you kind of step in here and talk about what your background is and the Sufi traditions, and then just go from there.
Let her rip.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to hear everybody's name first. So I'm Yaqeen or Lance, either way.
I'm Benita.
Deborah.
Lynn.
Jody.
Penny.
Bob.
Sharon.
Carla.
Yeah, so that's a start at inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And the man she's talking about, Shabda, is my spiritual teacher. Wasn't at the time when all this took place, but he has this great habit of, in a group like this, we'll each say our names and he'll go around and have everybody else say your name and you don't say it. Great way to learn everybody's name and also to bring them into your own heart, you know, in that way. And, you know, when you present your story, certainly the element of that, the idea of inclusion of every aspect of life, it's not particularly what I came to talk about tonight, but it's beautiful. And what I'm going to focus on is more the inclusion of the religious paths, as tools for awakening, to talk about, mainly because most of the conflicts we see in the world today have something to do with religious conflicts. And even to the things that are like kind of, you'd say maybe the fundamental, reactivity where, certainly in the Arabic countries, there's this reaction against the Western culture. It's doing away with our religious values. Religious values were a huge part of our, this thing that just happened, our presidential election. That's why there's so much passion around it. And so, I'm kind of jumping around here, but one of the questions that Carl asked is, why do we want to talk about inclusion? And, our election was a classic example of it. There were people who felt that our current president was an enemy, that he was somehow ruining our country. Now, instead of thinking of him as another American with a different point of view, which would be a lot more inclusive, maybe you didn't agree with that point of view. But anyway, we want to kind of go through a little bit of that, but I just wanted to start these remarks by saying this business of inclusion of the whole world or of your own foibles, your own joys, this really is the path of life. Expanding your heart that you can hold everything. This is really the path of awakening. And do you know the Buddhist monk that sometimes lives outside of Chino Valley, Garchen Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
So Garchen he's given a talk a couple of times at Prescott College. Keep your ear to the ground if it happens again. Well worth seeing, because I think this is, you hear stories of awakened beings. You wonder, can this be true? Can there be really a person who has what sometimes is called enlightenment? Go watch this guy and listen to him and see if you don't find that, in your own midst there is this being. And what in his story, he was a monk in Tibet when the Chinese came in. And I think monks pretty much were raised, from probably, I didn't hear this, but I think typically they're taken as very young, 3 or 4 years old, 5 years old, into the monastery. They grew up there. So he was maybe a teenager when the Chinese came and put him in jail, maybe early 20s, something like that. And as he told the story, he said that before that, basically Buddhism had been academic to him. It was what he was taught. You got to memorize this, you got to memorize that. We get up, we light the candles, we chant these things. But as a kid, just like going to church, right? Okay, whatever. But he said when he was in jail, it became beyond academic. It became real to him. And he began seeing his jailers, the people who were torturing him and his friends, killing him and his friends, he began to see them as victims, their own suffering that was caused, and the suffering they were creating, their own suffering that caused them to do the actions. And so he expanded his heart big enough to hold them in his own heart. Now, he didn't say it in that terms. I'm using this terminology to fit in with the subject of our talk. For him, it was a chance to practice Buddhism in its essence, love towards the people who are torturing him, for their benefit, not even for his own. He wasn't doing this to, he'd get favors, but it's like, look at the karma they're creating. They're going to have to pay for it if you believe in the Buddhist tenets. Actions of harm will come back to you. So there's an example of inclusion, why we want to talk about it. Okay, so I'm kind of rambling here. I want to go back to your questions. Is a form. It will help keep me on task.
Okay, so how does it pertain to the Sufi tradition? And I know that we talked about the.
Well, I want to go back to the first question that mm-hmm. you and I talked about, which is a little bit of my background.
Right.
And so because it was germane to this idea of religious inclusion. So I was raised in southern Indiana in the Bible Belt. There the ethnic groups were Baptists, Catholics. That was the ethnicity that we had. And the church I went to was a fairly fundamental Christian church, Protestant Christian church, in which, dancing was a sin and there was a lot of things. It was really my first introduction to religion. And I just want to clear the field by saying, when I talk about religion, I am not talking about institutions. I'm talking about the essence of that word, religion. Religio. It means to rejoin. So religion is about healing and rejoining something. Well, it's a koan. You can work with that. Well, what are you rejoining? But anyway, I want to say the word religion. If it brings up any trigger for you because of experiences you've had in institutional formats, do your best to let that go, because that's not what we're talking about. Nowadays, people use the word spirituality, and that is so that we can get away from that mm-hmm. those wounded places.
Mm-hmm.
But spirituality is religion. So anyway, in this church, I was taught at the age of 12, you were baptized in our church. And so you have religious education heading into that. And so I learned the word monotheism. And what does that mean? I was taught that it means there is only one God. Okay? I thought this was a pretty interesting idea, because it seemed like the next thing that was taught was, and our God is better than their God.
Yeah.
So I felt like there was, like, even at the age of 12, I thought, something is not quite right. That was really fascinating, as the Sufis are often found inside of Islam. They don't So we do a lot of Arabic practices, and the zikr that she's talking about, the basic phrase, La ilaha illallah, is there is no God except God. So basically it was the same thing. There's only one God. So, you know, right off the bat, I was shown that three supposedly major religions that are different have the same essential belief in monotheism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I mean, I didn't know that about Islam at the time, but certainly come to find that out later. So this education continues. I kind of like Jesus, you know. He sounds interesting. The church, I'm not too happy about, because I was 12, you know, and kind of feeling rebellious anyway. And the time comes when I could be baptized. And in the church, you stand up in front of everybody. The preacher says, "Can you accept Jesus as your Savior?" And, you know, the best I could at the age of 12, I thought, I like what I know about Jesus. And this is the first thing about why we have different religious paths, because different ways will the Spirit speak to you. So I was able to hear a little bit of the Spirit through Jesus. So I said, okay. And this would be my first initiation.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have that context or frame at the time, but so I said, okay. And then the preacher takes you upstairs, you put on a robe, and they had this big pool of water. It was above the altar, lit up, you know, the big cross, you know, big scene, and takes me in and dunks me in the water, brings me back up. And I remember the instant I came up feeling disappointed. And the thought I had at the age of 12, I can still clearly remember, is, what's the big deal? I'm just wet. Could have taken a shower.
Is that all there is?
Yeah, is that all there is? Yeah. Wish I had known that song. I could have sung. And it took me a few years to get a frame on that, because what that feeling was, you know, was that I had expected the experience that I was taught that Jesus had. I wanted to hear the voice of God. Mm-hmm. I wanted to hear, you know, God speaking, and everybody could hear, "This is Lance, my beloved son," you know, or whatever. I wanted to see doves. You know, even at that age, I must have had some sense that those descriptions in the Bible were, you know, they were symbolic in some way of some deeper experience. Now, fast forwarding a couple years, in college, I began the search, you know, for understanding. And I, at the time, like I said, I wouldn't have this kind of a framework, but I had had an awakening experience. Interestingly, it took me maybe 30 years to accept that, because I had always, you know, younger, I thought awakening experiences should be joyful ones. This is one of disappointment. But that disappointment, like, awoke something in me, you know, a searching, you know, that. So I'm in college. I walk into a bookstore, Bloomington, Indiana, which in those days was kind of, Bloomington was kind of like this jewel in the Bible Belt. And even though it was a small section, now, you know, back then you couldn't find religious books except lots of Bibles, but small section, and I see a book on Zen Buddhism, and I picked it up, and I thought, this is so diametrically opposite of, you know, Christianity, I thought I'd read about it. And I found out, you know, right off the bat, that the author was talking about samadhi, the state, or I think it calls satori, the Hindu word would be samadhi, this is a Japanese word. But the state that he was talking about was the state of timelessness, the state of unity, the state of acceptance. You know, it was all these amazing things that sounded a lot like what Jesus was talking about when he talked about heaven. So it's the first time that I started making a connection that whatever truth is, it manifests in different ways in different parts of the world at different times. You know, because what they were talking about, the Zen Buddhists were talking about, is exactly what I was looking for. I had this thirst for some kind of a spiritual experience. I didn't want words. I didn't want words that I love you, you know, that we all love each other. I wanted to feel that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel this commonality, this sense of unity. I wanted to feel this, you know, this existence. You know, Jesus said, you know, heaven is at hand. It's right here. It's not anywhere else. So, you know, what was that? So this is kind of like how I got started in terms of beginning to see that there is this universal path of awakening that gets framed in different ways. So here's a statement by a Sufi teacher, because to help kind of like put some more words on this. As water in a fountain flows as one stream, but falls in many drops, divided by time and space, so are the revelations of the one stream of truth. So that's a pretty simple way of expressing that. So Carla's next question was, why would we want to talk about inclusion? Well, you know, like I said, you can see that many conflicts these days have to do with religious differences. So right off the bat, there's a pretty good reason. The second one, if you want to take it back to this, the theme that you introduced about your personal experience, in order to, you know, have peace in your own heart, you have to be able to include all parts of yourself and all parts of the world.
Absolutely.
You can't walk around holding this thought that you're better than somebody else, you know, that they're better than you. You know. So why is there exclusion? Oh, here, I know, here's another good quote. Why we want to have inclusion. This is from the Tao, Chinese. The title, I love the title because it's in really big blue letters. Rigid behavior will kill you. This is the Tao, the translation of this verse. When alive, the body is supple and yielding. In death, the body becomes hard and unyielding. Living plants are flexible. In death, they become dry and brittle. Therefore, stubborn people are disciples of death, but flexible people are disciples of life. So now we've already mentioned four different religions here, or five. So we're moving along in the inclusive part of this talk. So why do we have this exclusion? Why does it arise? And, you know, part of it, I think, is indicated in this quote. Anything that is born has a life, and this life follows a certain pattern. In its youth, it's supple, and its old age, it's brittle. And then there comes death. So everything that happens in life, you know, this, everything that we see in the world of birth and death has this pattern. So this would also be true of religious teachings. So you have, you know, starting at this particular point, you have Jesus just passed away. You've got his teachings. They're wonderful. People who are with him love him. They can't wait to get this message out. They start getting it out. And as time goes on, it begins to become institutionalized. It becomes rigid. So what has to happen is somebody has to come along and break that rigidity and present the message new and alive again. So this is why there are different paths. It's just a nature of life, human behavior, people becoming brittle, ideas becoming brittle. Certainly, the classic story that is Buddha, you know, when he came into India, there was this pantheon of gods and goddesses. There was this solidified class of these were the priests, these were the warriors, you know, they're all these elements. And they'd become barriers to awakening instead of a path to awakening, which is how they're envisioned. If you go back and look at the Upanishads, and the earlier earlier Hindu texts, and, you know, that's what they were for. This is a path for awakening. Mm-hmm. There's the religious path, there's the warrior path. And so what Buddha did was throw out everything. You never hear Buddhists talk about God, because the name God had become a barrier instead of an opening. So Buddhism was a way of presenting the message without that barrier, you know, something new. And that's what it's taken. And if you want to see how this process works, you really want to like get jiggy with it. Joseph Campbell wrote this great book called The Hero of a Thousand Faces.
Yeah.
And it tells this story over and over again, you know, of the evil king who tries to control everything. And then the warrior, the hero who comes along and breaks that. I mean, we just retold that in The Feminine, you know, with what's that movie, the girl who's you know, has to fight her way out of the, what's the name of that? She's the archer.
Brave.
Oh. No, Brave is that. Yes, the Hunger Games is what I was thinking.
Oh, Hunger Games, okay.
Yeah, that was reframing the, you know, the hero myth. So, you know, which, by the way, is the myth that you all have to fight your own way through. You have to find that in yourself, you know, mm-hmm. your own rigidities and what have you. So another aspect of exclusion, why it exists in the world, and this is now from a Sufi perspective, we believe that what in the West we call the ego, we call the nafs, is this Arabic term, and we believe that everybody has a variety of levels of the nafs. The most basic ones are related to survival, getting what you have to do, you know. The highest ones are the ones that the saints live in, you know, dying for somebody else. You know, like what's the quote at the end of the Dickens novel, "'Tis a far, far better thing I've done." Where the guy gives his life for the woman who loves him who doesn't even return his love. It's just like, you know, that would be one of the highest stages of the nafs. So we call, there's a certain nafs, nafs amar, or the commanding nafs, that is based upon the idea of self versus other. And you can see this in our own country's history. For instance, in the time in which we were really after communists, and we said that communists were the enemy, mm-hmm. you know, the McCarthy era. So this represents a certain level of the nafs. We define ourselves by our enemy. We can blame everything on them, you know, it's like, just a certain level of your development, and we all have that. But in the awakening process, we want to move beyond that into the higher levels, you know, the places where we think of others more than ourselves, which is another segue here, which I thought about this too late to find it, but somewhere somebody sent me on the email showing that the golden rule can be found in like just about every religious path. I don't know if you've been here or seen that. And it lists the quotes, you know, out of the Bhagavad Gita or whatever, you know, how putting someone else's needs above your own, you know, is a basic tenet of all religions. You know, and that's obviously if you're in the first, that lower level of the nafs, you're putting yourself before everybody else. I got to get what I need.
Right.
So the whole business of talking about exclusion is to see that this is an operative aspect of your own personality and it's an operative aspect of cultures. So hopefully we can, you know, continue to evolve and move beyond that. You know, it starts by working on it yourself. You know, that's always a place it starts. So let's see, what other ideas did I have? So another thing is that, it's a great quote that I love, is that what we're looking for is unity, not uniformity.
Right.
So this
that's
is
a distinction.
It's a very basic distinction. So what it says is when you see the operation of the painful thinking, what you see is that we want everybody to believe in Jesus in the way that I do. That's, you know, like I read this great quote from this lady that she was actually complaining about, you know, the dances of universal peace that we do. And she says what we're doing is, she didn't say the word, but basically it's satanic. She says, go, yeah, I'm sure that's what she meant. And she says, go and tell your preacher about it, you know, and if he doesn't agree with you that this is satanic, find a new preacher.
Oh.
So it's like, she's even saying, don't trust that authority, you know. So obviously what she was saying is that I have the truth and nobody else does.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that leads to suffering. I mean, it leads suffering to her. It leads to suffering, you know, to me because of the way she said it. And it's like, you know, the gated community. It keeps everybody
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
Which was like, again, just scatter thinking here. But, you know, I started having trouble with heaven, that concept of heaven as being a gated community. And I know I, whenever I think about that, I always tell the story of when I was very young, next door to me was an old man and his wife, who were very sweet, had no children of their own, so they opened up their house to the neighborhood. And her name was Cookie, and his name was Pappy. Southern Indiana. And Cookie made pies. Oh, man, you could smell them in the neighborhood. And you'd go in, and she'd give you a pie, you know, a piece of pie. Pappy had his garage and get all oily and chew on this ugly cigar. And you could go out and, you know, play with him and get oily and, you know, as a young boy. And I, at some point in my awakening or development, I realized if I lived in a gated community, I would never have known them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tremendously enriched by them,
mm-hmm.
tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
They taught me a very simple form of love, you know,
mm-hmm.
that just by being a good friend. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the unity, not uniformity. I didn't need for Cookie. I didn't even want Cookie and Pappy to be like me. I wanted them to be uniquely who they are, that love could still flow through that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
yeah, let me just add something, because this kind of came to me the other day, and you know how folks put fences around their property and that kind of thing, especially out where I live, which is that wilderness area, and a lot of people put fences around their property, and when I moved out there, I don't have any of that, you know, and my neighbor told me that. You know, because I had an issue for a while with somebody racing up and down my driveway, you know, stuff like that. And he said, well, you need to put a fence there, and then, you know, you need to put a gate over the fence, and then it needs to say, keep out private property, you know. And I'm like, and that's what they've got. And I mean, that just does not resonate with me. I mean, even to the point that we've got free-range cattle out there, and of course there's all this wildlife, and I welcome all of that. And it occurred to me the other day that my neighbor, who's got a fence around his property, I guess, to keep the wildlife out, and yet the deer go right through his property. It's like you can't, you know, you cannot keep things out. And I think that was my whole point in the story that I was telling in the beginning, is that, you know, we try to create these separations, and there really is, you cannot separate. You know, we can do that artificially, perhaps, until the, you know, it becomes so strong it just breaks through anyway, because that's what needs to happen.
I had that in that same place. I was in the exact same trip that Carla was a couple years later, and the place she's talking about, I think, was called the Diggy Palace.
That's right, the Diggy Palace.
Yeah. And, it was the day that I was leaving, the group was leaving, and we were standing out in front, and anytime you hear a group of, you know, Westerners standing around, you attract a lot of Indians. And there was these gentlemen standing there, and one, I had already put on my travel mode. I was not thinking about where I was. I was thinking about, got to get home now. You know, so I'm not really being very open to what's around me. This guy is standing next to me, kind of a shorter guy. Hey, Mr., where are you from? Where are you from? America? You from America? You know, kind of ignoring him, and he said, hey, you know, I'm a human being too. I'm just being friendly. I don't remember his exact words, but that's what he was saying. Like, yeah, oh, it's great. I love your expression. That's exactly how I felt. Like, oh, God, what an asshole. You know, ugly Americans, you know, that was me right then. But it was a short version of your experience.
Yeah.
I was glad it was nice and short. I didn't have to go through all you went through. It was a momentary, like, embarrassment, but it really helped me to.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment, of course, I just needed to get grounded back in where I was. And,
mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I'm from Arizona. You know, where's that? It's in the desert, you know. Oh, like around here, you know, and started a whole conversation. And of course, in India, you're kind of tricked, because a lot of times people start conversations to get money from you.
Right. Yeah.
So it is like a little bit of a conflict.
Yeah.
So anyway, the last question that she'd put down is, how does this pertain to the Sufi traditions? And so what I thought I would like to do is bring you just a piece of a ritual that our Sufi teacher, Hazrat Inayat Khan, created. And I'll just, a brief background is, he was a musician in India. His grandfather was a very famous musician in Baroda, southern India. And he grew up in a quite eclectic household, surrounded by Hindus and Jews and Christians and Muslims, and his father was actually kind of a strict Muslim, but, you know, they all lived together in this compound, and he became a renowned musician on his own, winning competitions. He played, I think, the veena. You've seen sitars. It's kind of a more modern version of the veena. and he was a singer, and had some awakening experiences and met his own Sufi teacher, and his Sufi teacher said that you need to go to the West and harmonize the East and the West with your music. That's the phrase that we still say. And so he came to the West and spent about 19 years traveling around Europe, England, America, Russia. He was extensively traveled, planting seeds all around, and also trying to find some form in which to present the message. And this is the word that he uses, the message. And like the, one of the prayers we have is, may the message of God spread far and wide. And, you know, this would be a kind of a classic example of breaking through, you know, older forms in terms of what words and their associations have. So the word message, there's hardly any negative connotation to that. It's just like something is coming to you. You know, it's a message, it's coming to you. And, you know, as you delve into Sufism, he talks about, we talk about how the message of God speaks through all the teachers of humanity. So, you know, he's saying that this is, he's trying to find what's the form in which we can present the message today. And in 1910, he saw very clearly that religious intolerance was going to be the real challenge for the future. And so he presented the message of Sufism for our times in a very open fashion. As, like I said, in many countries, Sufism is basically Islam. It's the mystical side of Islam. But as he presented in the West, it's, you know, he wanted not to be in the framework of Islam, but in the framework that all religions, he talked about the unity of religious ideals. So he created a service that was a Western-style service. And he calls it the Universal Worship Service. And in that service, we honor all the religious paths. So I decided I would bring, you know, to us just a little piece of this, so you could get that feel of it. So I'm going to be using the word God. So like the word religion, God, the word God can have triggers for people. So please, if it does have a trigger for you, try and find a substitute when I say the word God. You know, the awakened being, samadhi, Buddha, Buddha mind. You know, there's many ways that it's expressed. So to the glory of the omniscient, omnipresent God, we kindle this light, symbolically representing the religion of Hinduism. To the glory of the omnipresent God, we kindle this light, symbolically representing the religion of Buddhism. Uh-oh. Anybody got any matches?
I think we do.
I'm going to check my gear.
This one.
To the glory of the omnipresent God, there we go. We kindle this light symbolically representing the religion of Judaism. To the glory of the omnipresent God, we kindle this light symbolically representing the religion of Christianity. Glory of the omnipresent God, we kindle this light, symbolically representing the religion of Islam. The glory of the omnipresent God, we kindle this light, symbolically representing. I'm going to have to figure out some way to do this. There we go.
Change purses. I have matches in my other purse.
Yeah, works out okay. Kindle this light. All right. There's a lot of giggling going on here.
I'm
going to
get these wet, yeah.
We kindle this light symbolically representing all of the native traditions. To the glory of God, we kindle this light symbolically representing the path of the mother, the goddess tradition. Now in this service, we would then take a reading out of each of these paths. So we've kind of already been doing that, been saying words from different paths, monotheism from Judaism, from Christianity. You know, this is the idea, to start to see that how through all of these different teachers, all of these different religious paths of awakening, there's one voice calling to us.
Mm-hmm.
There's one voice. It's calling us towards a higher self, towards that state of awakening that in which we no longer see us as separate from somebody else. Because once you make that connection like Garchin did, you can't see your jailer as your enemy. You see, it's just like if you have a child who goes astray and has to go to jail. Do you hate that child? No, you feel so sorry. You wish they didn't have to go through that suffering. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, that's really the religious path, is to learn to see all of nature, all of humanity, all of beings as being related. That doesn't mean that you don't have conflict, that you don't say no, that you're going to be sweet to everybody. I mean, there's going to be people you don't like. I mean, there's the reality side of this, but we cultivate this in our heart. And that's what the religious paths are for, is to cultivate that awakened state so that we can both enjoy our own lives and help everybody else to enjoy theirs. So as I was saying, this was the way in which Nikon presented this message. And the word Sufi, he was reluctant to use because words become solidifications, they become ossifications, they become brittle. And it's like you said, Sufism is really kind of anti-dogma.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Yeah, so we wouldn't use the word Sufi, except he said, people will call us something, so we might as well choose our own name. That's why he went with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of the ideas that I had today to kind of present, and glad to carry it further. But as she said, this is a dialogue, so
thank you, Lance. Thank you so much.